Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. Many books cross my desk that are interesting and often worthy of sharing with you, our listeners. But one very special book arrived at my home at the end of 2024, Elephants in the Hourglass, A Journey of Reckoning and Hope Along the Himalaya by award-winning writer and multimedia storyteller Kim Frank. It's a gem of a read and a fascinating tale. It's both a story of her adventures reporting on the elephant-human conflicts occurring in northern India's Himalayan region, and of a mom grappling with finding balance both in her parenting and the need to tell an underreported story here in the West. Frank shares a complicated tale of the relationship she fostered with people and the elephants they care deeply about. It's a relationship thousands of years old between the people of the region and captive Asian elephants, as well as a story of imperiled wild elephants in the area. The wild animals are finding it increasingly difficult to find safe passage to forage in an ever more populated and developed northern India. That leads to often fatal encounters for both people and the majestic, highly intelligent animals. Kim Frank is based in Sun Valley, Idaho, and joins us from her home there now. Kim Frank, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you so much, Dave. It is an absolute honor to be on this show. I'm a fan and really appreciate this time.
Oh, I appreciate that. I'd like to start with getting to know a bit about you for our listeners, because this story is really about your own personal inner journey, as well as the outer journeys to India and your encounters with these amazing animals. So tell us a bit about you and your family there in Idaho, because that's really kind of a big core of your being in this story.
It is very much. I had made that decision to write the book this way, hoping to reach a specific audience, actually. I have two daughters. They're now both in college. And I left a pretty high-powered activist, advocate, national career to stay at home full-time with my children about, 15, 20 years ago now. And I was a stay-at-home mom. And during that time as a stay-at-home mom, I went back to school to be a writer. I had always really wanted to be a mother. And when I first adopted, I have two daughters, they're both adopted from China. And when we first adopted our children, I was flying all around the country and I was leading an organization, and I mistakenly believed that somehow I was going to manage doing both, carrying my children around with me while I was lobbying and doing all these things. And I realized very quickly that I was actually becoming quite mediocre at both. I was not my best as a mom, and both of my daughters really needed a stable environment because of their adoption situation. And we were fortunate enough for me to be able to stay home full time. So during that time, and I talk about this in the book, I kind of lost my sense of self and I became very unconfident as a person. I went from being this kind of thriving, confident person to being quite timid and fearful. And then I went through a very difficult, painful divorce and kind of started fresh. And then I ended up exploring this story about Asian elephants and in India. And I was so determined to tell the story and felt myself so much on a quest to tell the story that here we are. The two ended up merging in the book.
I found it really touching, the story of you reconnecting with your childhood friend, David. And he plays a central role in really making this happen too, doesn't he?
100%. He is a superhero. He is my biggest champion. He was my first guy friend when I was in high school. When I was going through my divorce, we reconnected and he was also going through a difficult divorce, and we just immediately became best friends again. And I always looked up to him as a mentor, even as kids. He was always thinking outside of the box and taking action outside of the box. And I'll just give a quick shout out to his, some of his accomplishments, which I had no idea of when I reconnected with him, but he's done an incredible amount of deep ocean exploration and continues to be a leader in the in that space. And he's also a lawyer, but he's well known as kind of a problem-solving expedition lawyer. So he's also my best friend and my mentor, and he was very encouraging. When we reconnected, it was clear to him that I had, was not the girl that I had used to be, and he kind of was determined to help me get back to that place, to find my strength again. And to this day, it's been 11 years, and he still plays that role. So he's been a real champion for my work.
All right. Well, let's get back to, you were in Idaho, I believe, as I recall from the story. And then you run across a photographer named Jody. And tell us about how it unfolds that you all of a sudden now you've got a mission to go to India.
So India was never on my bucket list or really my radar screen. I had traveled internationally and traveled a lot in the country by myself. But India was not necessarily on the radar. At that time, I had been doing a lot of writing in other people's voices. I started becoming involved with the Explorers Club and was meeting a lot of people there who were writing for scientific journals about their expeditions, but not for kind of a mainstream population. And as a writer, I was riveted by their stories. And so I started partnering with some people to write their books or write their articles and about their work. At the same time, I was also becoming friends with a woman locally whose name is Jody, and she was a National Geographic photographer that lived here in the community. And so we became friends, and I was becoming increasingly feeling like kind of antsy to do a project that would I'd be able to write in my own voice instead of someone else's story. And we were on a hike one day, and she was telling me about how she had just come back from India, and she was along the Nepal border area, and she had met Avajan, actually. And he had taken her to see this community where all these wild elephants were being blocked by a wall, which is another story, but being blocked, and they were coming through the communities, and people were taking a ton of selfies and pictures, and every day more and more people were coming to see the elephants and trying to get photos. And the elephants were trying to make it between these tiny little patches of forest. And when she told me the story, something just like a little bell went off inside my head. I just couldn't even imagine the visual, and I don't actually even know. It just stuck inside. And so for days afterwards, I kept thinking about it and thinking about it. And then I thought, I wonder if she would consider taking me with her, and I would be the writer and she would be the photographer, and we would tell this story together. And even though I was friends with Jody, she also scared me to death because I was very intimidated by her. She's, you know, younger, she's beautiful, she's single, she's an adventure explorer out in the world on her own, doing things I couldn't even imagine doing. And, but she said yes. And so we went together and started the process of telling the story. Eventually, well, I won't give it away, but that's how it started.
Well, and it's interesting too, because she was doing an interesting trek of some kind. I forget exactly what it was, across India, which was, you know, just amazing on its own. And then, you know, you got to kind of meet up with her. And what I found really fascinating and fun and insightful was something I learned from this book was like, and it's a life lesson. It's when you make plans, they often go awry. So like in India and in your adventures, that, you know, the best plan is to just let it happen.
Absolutely. And there's this great irony in it, because when, you know, when you're there, everyone's asking you, well, what's your plan? And I would always be like, well, oh, I thought we weren't supposed to have a plan because the plans never work out. But everyone wants to know your plan. But if you have a plan, you can't count on it. So you always have to have part of your brain being ready for everything to fall apart and for something to emerge in its place. And honestly, the life lesson, you're absolutely correct. Of all the years I've been going back, I think that's the single most thing that has changed me as a human being, is this learning to live in the present and managing to both have a plan and be able to be flexible and let go of the plan at the same time. And that was not in my DNA.
Yeah, for a lot of us, I know we get it in our heads that this is going to happen and that's going to happen. And then when that doesn't happen, we get stressed out.
100%.
So let's talk about Indian elephants, because when most people think of elephants, they're thinking about the elephants of Africa. So tell us about some of the differences and where these elephants live and the different kinds of elephants, because that's what's interesting too. They're kind of have different roles in their elephant society.
Yes. And one of the things that has been a driving force for me is recognizing that there exists so much support internationally and knowledge of African elephants, which is terrific. However, people know very little about Asian elephants, and we tend to know the same things, such as, oh, in India, there's captive elephants and they're temple elephants and they're being abused. Or, oh, in Thailand, there's Asian elephants. You know, there are elephants in Thailand and don't ride them and they're being abused. The narrative hasn't really gone beyond that in a wide stream way. And so I've been very interested as I'm learning about Asian elephants that perhaps I can help be a Western conduit to raising a wider awareness so that there is bigger infrastructure and political will for Asian elephant conservation, particularly in India, where I've been studying them. So when I first started this project, I didn't even realize there were wild elephants in India. I thought all the elephants in India were captive elephants. But in fact, there are 30 to 50,000 Asian elephants in the wild. Their populations declined by 50% over the last 75 years. Half of those elephants live in India. About 500 of those elephants live in this very small part that I've been working on. And I'll speak to that later. So Asian elephants are interesting. They're different than African elephants in that, for one, they're smaller. They weigh less. They're not much smaller, but they are smaller. They have different types of ears. They have the top of their head looks like a little butt, actually. They have some pigmentation and some little hair. They're very cute. And so they look visibly different. The biggest, I think, difference in terms of their risk factors is that only male elephants can grow tusks. And the females have sometimes little tushes, but they don't have tusks. Female elephants, Asian female elephants, do not have tusks. And many male Asian elephants don't even have tusks. So poaching for tusks is not the biggest issue that Asian elephants face. They are classified as endangered, and they have traditional migration routes in India throughout the country where they forage for food and they move. So they don't migrate as a bird migrates. They migrate so that they can eat, because they eat so much. They spend up to 19 hours a day feeding. They can produce up to 220 pounds of dung per day. And they wander over an area that can cover up to 125 square miles. In order for the forests to replenish in their absence, that's why they move. So the elephants that I've been studying, they migrate from, they're forest elephants, and they migrate from the top of the northeast states in India, the ones I've been along the eastern Himalaya, through Assam, through parts of Bhutan, and then down through North Bengal, and then up through Nepal. And then they come back.
In your experiences with elephants in India that you've had over the years now, you know, there's two distinctive kinds of elephants that you encounter in your story. Mm-hmm. The captive elephants, and we'll talk about those in a moment, and the wild elephants. What I found interesting was there's interesting gender roles in elephant society, if you will. Could you just speak a bit about that? Because it seems like the matriarchs really are some of the most wise and amazing creatures of the elephant world there.
Absolutely. And research has actually shown that one of the other differences between, this is new research, African elephants and Asian elephants, is that while African elephants have one specific matriarch per herd, Asian elephants kind of share that role. They take turns with it. But that the herds are female dominated. So they're all female. They maybe have one male elephant that travels along with them for protection. If they have calves and they're males, the male elephants will stay with the herd until they get to be a certain age. And then they leave the herd. They are asked to leave the herd and they wander out alone. And so the bull elephants, the male elephants, are solitary, mostly. Sometimes they meet up in groups. That has a word, I want to say it's like majaran. I have to look the word up. But they sometimes run in little packs, kind of like, not unlike, you know, teenage guys. And so the males do that, and the females stay in these larger herds that have the aunties, the mothers, and the calves.
It's really like the sisterhood, the elephant sisterhood running the show.
100%. And what's compelling to me has been watching and learning from my colleagues that are in India how the herd behavior is changing in response to the human-elephant conflict in the populated regions. And we can talk about that in a bit.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we return, we'll continue our conversation with Kim Frank, author of the new book, Elephants in the Hourglass, A Journey of Reckoning and Hope Along the Himalaya. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's return now to our visit with author Kim Frank as we discuss her new book about the elephant-human conflict unfolding in India, Elephants in the Hourglass. The main impetus for your story is this conflict. And my big takeaway was 99% of this conflict is basically because of us, because the way humans act around these elephants. So could you just kind of give us a snapshot of what's the problems going on there with the villages and the tea gardens and these elephants that are really just trying to exist and find food?
Absolutely. So I'll start by giving the context of the region. So the area that I've been focusing on is called the Siliguri Corridor. It's sometimes referred to as the, quote, chicken neck of India. It is a sliver of land that connects all of India to the northeast states above it. It is bordered by Nepal, Bangladesh, and Bhutan. And above the area is the Himalaya mountain range and then Tibet beyond that. So it's a very highly strategic military political area. It is also a very, very rich biodiverse region that the bottom plains is almost at sea level. And then you're rising up to the third highest mountain in the world, Kanchenjunga. And that is visible on a clear day from the entire area. So there's already a very compact place. It is a place that has been historically, in recent history, populated by tea gardens, tea estates. So that when the British and Scottish took over, they created tea estates throughout this whole region in the plains. And then there have been indigenous communities and farmers and tea garden estate workers traditionally living in these areas, still maintaining the forest nature of this region. So, however, as the region has become more populated for military purposes and also to create a stronger infrastructure, to create more protection of that, bolster up that region. And also migrants are moving in, slipping in from the border areas and populating. The human habitats have become quite large, and the highways and the railways have also become quite large, displacing the forests. So now we have human habitats butting up very, very closely to the natural habitats. And while there are forest parks, like the national parks that are in the traditional migration routes that are attempting to help preserve the natural habitat, it's not enough. There are these corridors that the elephants have to move through, then they have to cross through highways and trains, and they're getting very close to human habitats. So they're starting to come in when the crops are being cultivated so that they can have a quicker, faster, easier nutrition by eating the crops, the rice crops and the maize crops. And so this is creating obviously massive conflict where throughout India, approximately 500 to 600 people die a year from interactions with elephants, and approximately 100 elephants die per year from human-caused accidents. It is against the law, with a huge steep consequence, for people to harm an elephant in India. So there's no shooting them or culling them or anything like that.
And one of the things I found interesting, and I could see where it leads to a lot of difficulties, is that the village people who are impacted by the elephants coming into their, you know, and sometimes destroying their homes, these things happen, and it sounds like quite regularly, mm-hmm. that there's also this feeling that this government agency should take care of it. It's like, you know, that's not our job, it's your job. And it's like, whose responsibility is it to take care of this and try to resolve this conflict?
Absolutely. And that's, I think, one of the key factors that is creating, you know, people have said to me, you know, you can't tell the story of the human elephant conflict in India because it's way too complicated. And I think, well, I'm going to give it a try. and I appreciate the patience of people helping follow me along as I'm giving it this try. So the Forest Department in India is tasked with maintaining the wildlife in the national parks and in these regions. And they aren't well funded. They don't have a lot of support, and there aren't that many of them, frankly, enough as this area and region grows in population to be able to manage all the elephant conflict that's occurring. So what happens is you have a community that has a crop field, and the crops are about to be harvested, and the elephant herds are already in the area coming in. They come at night. And technically, the Forest Department's job is to shoo them away without hurting them. And so what that means is, you know, sound guns or sirens or, you know, just sometimes even driving them, which is not great for elephants, but they don't even have that many options available to them. And so it's like a game of ping pong. They're pushing the elephants one place into the other place, and the elephants, they're trying to push them back into the forest. So it's a thankless job. The villagers now, there are these things called community response teams. So now the communities are being trained and given the tools to help be a first responder. That's one of the solutions that's being employed. And so now the communities can use the tools, and they have like WhatsApp groups and walkie-talkies, and they're able to communicate to each other and say, oh, the elephants are coming your way, and they can coordinate a bigger, they're partnering with NGOs in the region. And so that's kind of how they're managing it in the crisis, in the peak of the season in the crisis.
It also was interesting that the elephants come up with their own strategies to confound some of these things. And I found that to be really fascinating that, you know, they come up with, you know, literally like, oh, okay, you think we're going over there? We're going over here now.
It's riveting. The stories that people on the ground have been sharing, while at this time are still anecdotal, are absolutely astonishing. That, for one, the elephant herds are, the female elephant herds are using like a military strategy. Instead of having their herd of 150 go into one crop, they now have started breaking up into much smaller herds, knowing that there aren't enough people to get to all of them at one time. And so they will divide and conquer, and then they'll come back together at night. So there are countless stories of different strategies that the elephants are using, even as far as some of the barriers. Electric fences are illegal, but sometimes people will put them up, and the elephants have learned how to take a stick of wood and use the wood as a tool to move the electric wire out of the way so that the rest of the herd can pass. I mean, the stories are endless, and that's kind of where I want to go with my next project, is dig more deeply into those stories.
Yeah, it's like guerrilla elephant foraging tactics.
100%.
Yeah, very interesting. Okay, let's talk about the culture of India, the millennia's old culture, and their intricate relationship with elephants and the captive elephants. And you, when you start on your journey, you're looking for a kind of a legendary woman there. And I'd like you to tell us a bit about her, Parbati Barua, if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Absolutely. When Jody and I first sat down to plan out what we wanted to do when we went over, we wanted to tell this story about wild Asian elephants and the selfie culture and this thing she saw. And then she said, you know, I happened to see this, there's this woman who, she was a princess. She was born into a royal family in Assam. And she's known as one of the only female mahouts, which is an elephant caregiver, trainer. Back in the day when it was still legal, there were these people called fandis, and they were at the top of the mahout chain, and they could actually capture elephants for sale, capture elephants while riding an elephant. And she had earned her way up to that rank, probably the only woman Fandi known in the world. So she was a really compelling, we really wanted to know, could we find her? Would she meet with us? And about 30 years ago, a British writer named Mark Shand, he wrote a famous travel book called Travels on My Elephant. Anyway, when I did my deeper research, we discovered that he had actually rode with her on elephant back across this northeast part of India to document the human-elephant conflict 30 years before we even started to do this, and the BBC had made a documentary. So that kind of increased our interest. We really wanted to go find her. So a lot of my work initially was in trying to get this kind of wisdom from her and learn about this historic past when people lived in kind of, I don't know if I'd say harmony, that's romanticizing it, but where elephants and people lived together in the villages and worked together. And, that is a dying tradition because of the wildlife laws now. But it was very compelling to me to learn more about that.
And could you tell us a bit more about the mahouts that you encountered? One in particular who had an elephant, and I don't know if those guys are still together, if the elephant's still alive. The elephant had a tumor, as I recall. And I found it really deeply moving, your descriptions of the relationship between that mahout and the elephant.
When we first started, we received Forest Department permissions to document with the Forest Department staff and in the Forest Department. And at that time, our interest became deeply into the connection between the mahouts, which are the elephant caregivers, and the elephants. And almost to the point where we kind of set aside the wild elephant component a bit to deeply study this historic relationship. And what's happened is that traditionally, there were elephant caregivers who had all this elephant wisdom for captive elephants. They captured the elephants. They used the elephants for logging at one time, transportation, temples, shows. In the Forest Department currently, they are the only entity, unless they've been grandfathered in, that are allowed to, quote unquote, own elephants. So all the elephants that have been abandoned or they can't relocate back into the forest, they become working elephants of the Forest Department. And ironically, they actually walk through, they patrol with the mahout and the Forest Department. The elephants are agents of conservation. So they go into the national parks every morning, early in the morning, and check to make sure the one-horned rhinos are safe from poachers. And the terrain is so thick that you couldn't possibly safely get through there any other way. So you can very quickly see why this is a useful tool. The mahouts traditionally had very, very deep, deep bonds. Each mahout would have one elephant for their whole lives, for the elephant's life, and sometimes just for the mahout's life. So the dedication, what I saw while I was there at that time, was there was a synergy, particularly between this one mahout that I had met, Faridul, and his elephant, Surya. And Surya was a massive tusker, and his mahout was this teeny thin bird-like shaped man who was very gentle. Yet the stories about this mahout and elephant team was that they rode in, you know, they would be able to drive a herd of 150, the two of them, to move them out of the village into the safety of the forest. And I first met that mahout and elephant team when Surya was still healthy, and subsequent trips he had a tumor and Ferdal was devoting his life and time to caring for Surya. And so I was witness to that over time without giving away the end.
It's quite a beautiful bond that you described.
Mm-hmm.
Let's take a break, but stay with us. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Kim Frank, author of the new book, Elephants in the Hourglass, A Journey of Reckoning and Hope Along the Himalaya. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's return now to our conversation with Kim Frank as we discuss her new book, Elephants in the Hourglass. It documents the human-elephant conflict unfolding in the Himalayan foothills of India. Let's talk about the good, the bad, and the ugly, mostly bad and ugly, of social media and the problem with selfies, because we're seeing it in the United States in the national parks, like, mm-hmm. for example, in Yellowstone National Park with bison, and people just behaving moronically that don't understand. These are wild creatures, and they need to be respected and, you know, observed at a distance.
Absolutely.
And yet, what you see happening in India with these elephants is not that.
We started the project, and our project that we were going, we, you know, we start, Jody and I started writing grants to get support to do this, and we were calling the story Dying for Likes. And it is absolutely a huge factor in the management of wild Asian elephants. It's a huge headache for the Forest Department. And there are people on YouTube that are calling themselves conservationists, but in fact, they're basically, you know how like people run after tornadoes, that storm chasers?
Yeah,
That's exactly the feeling. They're running after wild Asian elephants, and and it's a bind for me. I'll tell you, there's two things. There's one, there's this, this dying for likes. Literally, they're putting themselves at risk. People get killed, and they're inspiring others to do it because, oh, that's cool. I'm going to go out and do this. And I find there's an ethical dilemma for me, actually, because, I'm making a documentary right now. I'm in the middle of making a doc. I'm towards the end of the documentary, and I have been utilizing some of these YouTubers, their footage to show how horrible this situation is. And I think, you have to be so careful with that because I'm not advocating that people go out there and use their camera and interrupt wildlife. And yet, the film will be benefiting from those who have done that so that I can make the point that you shouldn't be out there doing that. So it's a very interesting time, I think, the way that we're destroying our own environment and our own habitat for the purpose of selfies, for the purpose of being liked.
And a lot of that, I think, just really stems from ignorance and disconnection from nature and the natural world. And I want you to know that I appreciated your inner conflict and your musings on it. It's kind of like the Heisenberg principle in physics, where, because you're there as the observer, you're also making an impact on what you're observing.
Yeah. I grappled with that. And in fact, there was a scene in the book where the woman I was staying with, Sonia, at the Tea Garden Estate, I was hell-bent. I needed to experience the conflict for myself. And she was saying, well, why? Why do you need to be a cowboy? Why can't you just, why do you have to go there overnight? And why can't you all just leave them alone? And I said, well, it's important the world know about this. And I think for a long time, I think that this extends way past elephants in India. I mean, how many of us as writers, as storytellers, or journalists, or documentary filmmakers feel that well, it's okay if we do it because we're doing it for a greater good. I think, frankly, that now that I have experienced it and felt the shame of that experience and being there and what I was doing, it made my responsibility feel a hundredfold. So I, if I haven't slept in 7 years, that's probably why.
Well, and it also takes me back to the title of your book, The Elephants in the Hourglass. It's quite a metaphor that time is, those sands are running out if we don't start doing things right.
Absolutely. And I don't know what it's going to take. I mean, I think about this every day. I think when, for example, if this is just the most basic example, if we went to the store and used a plastic bag and the bag burnt us and gave us blisters on our hands, we would probably stop using plastic bags. But I think unless we keep becoming more and more inoculated and more detached to the point that something has to, like, for example, when COVID happened, for maybe a week, the whole world, out of fear, stayed indoors. And nature came roaring back in a very short period of time. The Venice canals were clear again, and you could see the Himalaya from Delhi, and so much nature came rebounding back when we stayed inside for a week. But even having experienced that, after that week, our fear was like, oh, okay, well, maybe I'm not going to die. And out we went. And I'm not saying we should just stay inside all the time. I'm saying we have the collective power to actually do something. But unless we're faced with the threat in our face, like immediately, it seems as if we are just not. So I don't know the answer.
It is difficult, and it's one of those. It's definitely a catch-22, because one of the other things that happened during COVID was a lot of people discovered, well, I'm safe if I go out in the woods away from people, because you know the trees and the animals aren't going to give me COVID. So then you had a lot of people who really don't have much experience being out in nature suddenly desiring to do that. And I think that's a lot of, you know, what's caused this flocking to the national parks and trying to get, you know, selfies with bison, or in that case, elephants.
Well, that's very true. And in fact, I'm sitting in a community that was that had that exact experience. I live in a very small tourist town at the edge of the wilderness in Idaho, in Sun Valley. And during COVID, so many people flocked here for refuge. And there's a tipping point to a culture, I think, that, you know, if you come to a place and there's you're a small group coming to a place with a big group, you absorb the existing culture of respect for nature and balance and coexistence and all that. But if you come and you kind of outnumber the existing culture, then you bring your own culture in, and it and the existing culture of respect of nature gets kind of lost. And that's what we witnessed here. And it was interesting, very interesting.
Well, let's talk a little bit about one of the really cool experiences it must have been. I was fascinated by it, is you got to ride an elephant. And you and Jody, as I recall, were on elephant back. Could you tell us what that experience is like?
I will say, for starters, I definitely, just to put this caveat out there, I am not in support of elephant riding as a tourist industry, especially in the scenario where the elephants are being, you know, the captive elephants are being abused, or there are these huge howdahs, is what they're called, these big frames that are placed on elephants, and all the tourists are sitting there and dangling, and they're reading their, what, you know, they've got their iPads, and it's completely, that's a different thing. What we were able to do is we had Forest Department permission to observe the Forest Department patrols, both with Parbati Barua and also with the Forest Department, the elephant patrols. So, you know, we did go on the tourist ride at one of the parks. It was horrifying. I was very torn about that, and also grateful to experience that particular thing so I can understand it. At the other park, there was a very strict care for the elephants, where, you know, they had all these layers of very soft blankets, and you couldn't have more than a certain amount of weight. The elephants didn't work over a certain period of time. They had the nights and the afternoons free in the forest. So there are all these things. All that said, being on an elephant with my feet touching the sides of the elephant and feeling that history of that, for me, the history was what I felt the closest to. I didn't feel so much like, oh, this majestic creature, they should all be captive and I should be riding this majestic creature. It was more this feeling of, wow, I am transported into this thousands of year old history of human elephant relationship and bonding when it is at its best. And it felt, you know, it felt so peaceful, so magical, really. It felt really magical. And so take that experience in a vacuum, in a bubble, because, of course, the truth of that experience is that in order for an elephant to be a captive elephant, they go through most of them go through a very brutal training called the Crush that, you know, you've seen, I'm sure, videos and pictures of where they've been, you know, tied up. And there's a lot to say about that. Parts of India have never used that as a tool for training. And traditional mahouts will tell you that, you know, the positive reinforcement and lullabies and bonding is the most important thing. And that part is over quickly. And it's so complicated. Social media has made it, you know, there's a one and done. Never ride elephants or you're contributing to this crush. And so I obviously, for the mainstream world, respect that and would promote that. At the same time, the experience I had and that I write about felt very sacred, very sacred.
Yeah, what I felt when I was reading that part was I thought to myself, what would it have been like if Kim could have been transported back 1,000 mm-hmm. years to see what that India looked like pre-colonization by the British?
Absolutely.
Pre-industrialization, when it was a truly natural mm-hmm. landscape that, you know, also, you know, humans were a big part of that. I found that to be really a very deeply moving part of the story.
Thank you. It very much felt that way. I felt like that was what I was seeking. When I wanted to find out more about Parbati, I was seeking a portal into that experience. I wanted to understand the history so viscerally so that I could understand what was happening in modern times. I felt as a storyteller that, you know, I couldn't just go there and try and understand. And that was, I felt, the closest I could get to that time, for sure.
Well, and I would be remiss. You mentioned Avijan Sahab earlier, the beautiful photograph on the cover of this book. Could you tell us just a bit about him?
Yes. I met Avijan at the first trip because Jody had actually met him when she had met him first and then brought him in when we both showed up at the same time. Avijan has been working in that area tirelessly. He gets up every single morning in his home in Siliguri with his camera on his scooty, and he goes out into the villages. He spends the night with villagers. He's tracking the elephants. He's photographing the elephants. His biggest, most important desire was to have a voice that would be amplified to bring this attention to a Western audience. And so I started working with him right away to try and write articles where his photography would be featured, not so much so that he would be a famous photographer, but I mean, that wasn't what he was seeking as much as that the world would know about this story and that his, because he spends so much time in the field, that his photographs really bring to light what's happening there. And he's been working with local villagers and communities. And even there was a village that the tea garden estate had been let go. The lease had been let go. And the tea garden grew up wild around the people that were stuck there. The people who had worked there for generations were now stuck in the center of this tea garden. And leopards were coming in and eating all their animals, essentially, their cows, their dogs. And so in order to help stop them from turning to poaching and stealing from the forest, he went in and worked with that community to teach them how to farm and how to reclaim their tea garden. And so he was a real hero in a way. He's been a real hero in a way. And there are many other people I've worked with in that region that are like that. And they have this incredible work that they're trying to do. And my God, they're just like little dots in a big giant landscape. So my hope is to help bring light to their work.
Well, we're about out of time, Kim, but before we let you go, what are the next steps for you in this story?
So the next steps for me is that I'm making a documentary that is called Where the Forest Roars. I'm headed to London tomorrow to finish the edits, and that's very exciting. It's been a learning experience for sure. I have a special mentor that has been helping me along the way. And I am returning to India to do a project along the ancient Asian elephant migration route, where I'll be collecting oral histories and trying to get deeper into the relationship and the stories of the elephants. So I'm not stopping yet.
Well, Kim Frank, author of Elephants in the Hourglass, I just want to let you know how much I enjoyed this story and found it to be powerful. And you're a real life hero. Thanks for being you.
Thank you, Dave, so much for giving me a chance to tell this story and for sharing it. I really, really appreciate it.
Thanks again to our guest, Kim Frank. You can get her book, Elephants in the Hourglass, A Journey of Reckoning and Hope Along the Himalaya, published by Pegasus Books, at most major booksellers or order it from your local bookstore. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of Cap Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.